So turning now to the Mercury News and a new law that was passed and signed by Governor Newsom involving supposedly an attempt to reduce police shootings by requiring a higher standard of threat before you shoot the suspect. Well, here's the article by Nico Savage, and they're kind of taking a new twist and looking at it. New law could bolster police training, says the Mercury News yesterday. Use of force law's goal is to help officers handle deadly situations. Now, this is, to me, it's an example of, I don't know if it's police department-inspired spin or police department pandering spin or wishful thinking, but here's the story. It's called, it's under the same, under the motto, reducing police shootings, or at least the logo, there we go. Officers could get more training on how to defuse tense situations and head off potentially deadly encounters under a California law signed by Governor Gavin Newsom Monday that aims to reduce police shootings, according to experts on police tactics. But Morgan Hill Police Chief David Swing said he sees little difference between the new use of force law, what it requires, and the training officers in his department already receive. I don't see substantial changes to our training because things like de-escalation, crisis intervention, things of that nature are already woven into many aspects of our training, Swing said, adding that he doesn't expect the scenarios used to train officers in when and how much force should be used will change, quote, in any meaningful way under or as a result of the law. Supporters of the law, including Newsom, have described the legislation as a landmark change that makes California's use of force standard among the most stringent in the country, supposedly to protect the citizens from, shall we say, ambitious or wild and crazy cops. It is not yet clear how the new law will affect police officer training or how long it will take to provide any new training to the over 80,000 sworn law enforcement officers across the state. And it is likely to be years before it is known whether the new standard ultimately reduces the number of fatal officer-involved shootings in California, as the law supporters hope it will, or make policing more dangerous for officers, as some law enforcement officers have cautioned it will do. The new law requires that police officers use deadly force only when, quote, necessary, in response to an imminent threat of death or serious injury, while the previous statute required only that the use of force be reasonable rather than simply necessary. But as a result of an amendment, the law does not define necessary, leaving it open to interpretation by police departments. That change and other amendments to address concerns from law enforcement groups, i.e. police unions, led some police reform advocates who initially supported the legislation authored by Shirley Weber, a Democratic assemblywoman from San Diego, to turn against it. Nothing's going to change under the new law, said Rosie Chavez, an organizer with the social justice group Silicon Valley Debug, one of the groups that pulled its endorsement of the law. But while its impact on some police agencies may ultimately be minor, supporters say the legislation is a baby step in the right direction. Actually, it's a step in the right direction. I use the word baby to be a little derogatory about this article, because California's previous law set among the lowest standards for the use of force in the country, and the rate of fatal police shootings in the state is higher than the national average. Supporters say the statute could spur law enforcement agencies that are not yet training officers in de-escalation tactics, methods aimed at keeping officers and citizens safe in potentially explosive encounters, to finally do so. The hope is that this will force agencies that have really lagged behind professional norms to catch up, said University of South Carolina law professor Seth Stofton, who studies police use of force statutes. As a result of the law, officers might receive new training in building rapport and getting people to comply with orders without resorting to force, or learn to identify the circumstances when it's appropriate to wait for more help to arrive at before shooting a suspect dead. I'm sorry, before approaching a suspect, Stofton said. That's because the new law requires prosecutors to examine not just the moment the force was used, but also the officer's actions leading to that point, to see if an officer's actions might have improperly escalated the situation, according to Stanford law professor Robert Weisberg. Under the new law, officers could face criminal charges if a prosecutor finds that although they used deadly force appropriately, there was no need to get to the fatal point, he said. Take, for example, the February 9th police shooting of 20-year-old Willie McCoy in the drive-thru of a Vallejo Taco Bell restaurant. Police said McCoy was asleep in the driver's seat of the car, had a gun on his lap, and moved forward before six officers fatally shot him. Under the new law, all the officers' tactics adding up to that or leading up to that point would be subject to scrutiny, including their decision to surround the car from a few feet away rather than take cover, a tactic an attorney from McCoy's family criticized. McCoy's family and others in Vallejo have called for the officers to face criminal charges, something that almost never happens in police shootings. An independent use of force expert concluded in a report released by Vallejo officials that the officers acted appropriately. The Solano County District Attorney's Office has yet to rule on whether the shooting was justified. Don't hold your breath, folks. How many departments could ultimately need additional training as a result of the new law is also unclear. Swing, the Morgan Hill police chief and a former president of the California Police Chiefs Association, said he could not think of any department that do not any departments that do not already provide some form of de-escalation training for officers. A spokeswoman for the California Commission on Peace Officers Standards and Training, which will play a key role in implementing the role, said the commission will update state police training standards to reflect the new law, but did not detail what those changes would be. And that's a story in the Wednesday, August 21st, Mercury News. New law could bolster police training. Use of force law's goals is to help officers handle deadly situations, by Nico Savage. Turning now, however, to the Black Lives Matter Global Network, here's what they had to say about this law and why they withdrew their support. The Black Lives Matter Global Network, BLM, has proudly served as one of the 13 community and civil rights organizations co-sponsoring AB 392. That's the bill we're talking about. The California Act to Save Lives, a bill authored by Assemblymember Shirley Weber, Democrat of San Diego, to address police brutality and violence by updating California's deadly use of force law. The BLM, Black Lives Matter, has worked closely with the lawmaker and coalition partners to ensure that the legislation responds to and aligns with the communities and families impacted by police violence. BLM and its chapters, including BLM LA, worked to build momentum around the bill, especially within communities of color. BLM LA chapter lead, Melina Abdullah, states, "We knew that it would be an uphill battle, especially with police associations opposing the bill. Unfortunately, in efforts to get law enforcement to lift their opposition, the bill was so significantly amended that it no longer is the kind of meaningful legislation we can support. As a result, BLM has withdrawn as a co-sponsor of the bill." BLM co-founder Patrice Cullors states, "While BLM applauds the lawmakers, the organizations, and especially the families of those killed by police who have worked to move policy forward and help to change the culture of policing in California, we now have deep concerns with the amendments taken to the bill. The bill was initially written to do three things. One, change the police use of force standard from reasonable to necessary. Two, require de-escalation by police officers. And three, hold officers who violate these criminally liable. Amendments to the bill significantly weaken all three of these provisions and by virtually all analyses provides the greatest guidance during litigation or after someone has been killed by police, instead of working to prevent police killings and the devaluation of human life within our communities, which was our intention. In addition to amendments to the bill, the tethering together of AB 392 and SB 230, introduced by Senator Ana Caballero, Democrat of Salinas, and supported by police associations, calls for increased budget allocation for law enforcement. This is in direct contradiction with Black Lives Matter's call for divestment from police and investment in local communities." unfortunately, is now written, AB 392 does not provide the kind of substantive change that we imagined when the process began. While we are aware that it will likely pass without us, we feel compelled to take a strong stance consistent with our commitment to our communities to ensure police accountability and divestment from the police force. Despite different approaches with some of our partners, we look forward to continuing to work together. We deeply appreciate the vision, leadership, and courage of Assemblymember Weber and hope to work together on other issues. And I'm afraid it's not more specific than that. And here's a little more, a June 15th story from the San Francisco Chronicle. Some activists pull support from California Compromise on police deadly force. I can get to it here. A little trouble, we can do it. Here we go. Sacramento, like dozens of other Californians whose family members were killed by police, Quintus Moore traveled to the state capitol in April to ask lawmakers to raise the legal standard for when officers can use deadly force on a suspect. After hours of testimony, the bill they were lobbying for passed out of its first legislative committee. Moore said it felt like a ray of hope that he would finally get justice for his son, who was fatally shot at a shopping mall last year by Los Angeles police. Everybody was so happy and so grateful and so thankful that we thought we were finally going to be able to have some oversight, said Moore, 60, a substitute elementary school teacher from Los Angeles. Two months later, he is seething over a compromise that proponents of the measure, AB 392, negotiated with law enforcement organizations. That deal cleared the path for the measure to become law, but has divided the activists who rallied for the bill and shared their painfully personal testimonials at legislative hearings. Some groups that originally backed the proposal, including Black Lives Matter, withdrew their support. Others swallow their disappointment, believing that any steps toward a tougher use of force standard would be an improvement. Nobody thought it was going to be easy, but I thought we would win it, said Melina Abdullah, co-founder of the LA chapter of Black Lives Matter. She said her organization would have not have signed on as a sponsor of the bill if it had been introduced in its current form. I believe we can win more and could have won more, Abdullah said. AB 392 would give California one of the strongest laws in the country on police use of force. The measure would direct officers to use deadly force only when necessary in defense of human life, but does not explicitly define what would be considered necessary, though courts could consider the actions of both police and the suspect when determining whether an officer was justified in opening fire. Current law, established by a pair of U.S. Supreme Court cases, considers lethal force to be justified if a, quote, reasonable officer in similar circumstances would have acted the same way. California police killed 172 people in 2017, the most recent year for which data are available. According to the State Justice Department, an increase of nearly 10% over 2016. The data do not distinguish between shootings and other types of force, such as blunt impact or chokeholds. And here's an aside. I sent an email to our own Santa Cruz police chief, or their own police chief, Andy Mills, to request what the current Santa Cruz policy is on chokeholds. I looked through his police policy manual, at least part of it. It's a pretty thick, long manual. And there are provisions for supposedly guiding the use of tasers, guiding the use of, carotid artery restraint holds. Pepper spray, things like that, but not chokeholds, at least not as they are described in the media, such as killed Eric Garner in 2014 back in New York, the guy who was gasping, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe," as he was taken down for the crime of illegally selling cigarettes. Law enforcement groups were intensely opposed to the original measure, arguing it would put officers in danger by causing them to second-guess their actions. They dropped their objections after proponents scaled back some of the language, including a requirement that officers exhaust all alternatives before using deadly force. The bill would now order officers, when possible, to use techniques to de-escalate the situation before shooting. And skipping ahead here to see if I can get any more details. Organizers at the Anti-Police Terror Project, an Oakland community organization, maintained their sponsorship of Weber's measure after checking with the families they work with whose relatives have been shot to death by police. Co-founder Kat Brooks said she initially felt little agitation and some sadness about the amendments, which she said showed how powerful police, how law enforcement remains in Sacramento. The families decided it was better to get some change than none at all, she said, and didn't want to bail on the Weber bill, who has been there for us. We felt obligated to uphold their wishes, and we get a lot of more defense of it. Activists from Black Lives Matter, however, said the changes went too far to appease law enforcement. Abdullah of Black Lives Matter pointed to two changes that made it impossible for her organization to accept the compromise. One reinserted references to how an objectively reasonable officer would interpret a confrontation, which Abdullah said was too similar to the current standard. The other linked AB 3392 to another measure backed by police groups, and we've talked about this in the earlier article, that would spell out new guidelines for department use of force policies and provide additional money for training. As Black Lives Matter, we believe what really makes communities safe is mental health funding and housing and those kinds of things, Abdullah said. We don't want to be a part of a legislative package that expands funding for police, as mentioned before. Abdullah said of the 17 families with whom Black Lives Matter was working, with which to pass the bill, 15 did not support the new version. We're disappointed because we invested a significant amount of time and energy and so forth. Moore was among the family members who urged Black Lives Matter to withdraw their support. His 30-year-old son, Gregario Mack, was fatally shot by two L.A. police officers in April 2018 when he was carrying a knife through a mall in the Baldwin Hills neighborhood. Moore said his son who had asked security guards for a psychiatrist was having a mental health episode. When police confronted Mack, he took off running, and the two officers opened fire. According to a review by the L.A. Board of Police Commissioners, Mack fell to the ground, then sat up, reached again for his knife, and began making slashing motions across his throat. Believing he was trying to stand back up, the officers each shot Mack one more time. The commission ruled in March the officers violated departmental policy when they fired the final rounds because Mack no longer posed an imminent threat. Moore wants the officers fired and prosecuted, but he has not heard anything from the police department or the DA's office since the commission issued its judgment. Moore said police need to face accountability for their actions so they will stop and think about what they are doing before they shoot a suspect. He no longer believes that can be achieved through AB 392, which he compared to a toothless Rottweiler trying to guard its owner's backyard. What good is that, he said? What good is having a Rottweiler with no teeth? And that's most of an article by Alexei Kosev, San Francisco Chronicle staff writer. Some activists pull support from California Compromise on Police Deadly Force. And now we're going to have another deadly little vanilla round with Capital Steps.
Obamacare is a disaster. It's a disaster. It's a shame it has not been turned into the much better Trump care. We got a great plan. These doctors are going to explain it so well. And they wouldn't explain it as well as I would. But they're going to explain it, and you can trust them because they got their medical degrees at Trump University.
I'm Sam.
And I'm Ella.
And together we're
Sam and Ella.
We think America's paying too much for health care.
So just call 1-800-DOCS-R-US.
Teresa said, I can't believe it's a health care plan.
Ooh, call now and get your own at-home eye exam. You know, an eye exam can help you live longer.
How's that?
It'll make you die late. If you should try to find a doc in the directory and you lack a healthcare card,
call our No Home Docking Network.
Dial direct to me.
Appendectomy's not hard.
You can suit yourself at home. Suit yourself in front of your family.
We'll do it for just a song.
Who cares if maybe we get it wrong? Consider your home well stocked. Your
Hoover can do liposuctomy. If you want to bob your nose, just use a wrench and a garden hose. Over the phone, I'll help you do your own vasectomy.
And I like to re-quick slip.
And if your scissors make a slip, then you can say to me,
that's okay, Doc, keep the tip.
Who offers a cheap CAT scan?
A veterinarian. If we're the doctors that you always call up first.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
I drop
who?
I dropped my kielbasa into my patient during an operation.
Did you find the missing link?
No, because when the politicians fight about health care, it's the patient.
Who always ends up with the worst?
Suture Yourself from Make America Grin Again. And I found this next bit, which I'm going to play the audio track for you online. It's part of a series called Hysteria. It's a looks like a either a TV show or a podcast show. It's titled The Black Bloc Inside America's Hard Left. And it features a lot of interesting video of the Black Bloc tactic. But more interesting to me was the description of Black Bloc tactics, perhaps no longer so much in the media now that we are 9 years or 8 years past the Occupy movement and when there was actually protests across the country and at times that involved Black Bloc tactics, which are going to be described in this this audio segment of the video. I encourage you to check it out online if you'd like. It's, I think, a conservative critical view of the Black Bloc. If you consider it, if you consider the visual element as well, but the audio is, I think, instructive and interesting, and that's why I'm playing it.
Get the fuck up!
Fear is a part of our tactics. We do want Nazis to be afraid to organize in public. It's our job to go out there and say, no, we're not going to allow you to spread these ideas.
Let's talk and make it clear.
Fascists are not welcome here.
Politically, I'm an anarcho-communist and I'm an anti-fascist, and right now I'm focusing a lot on that anti-fascism. So what I'm doing here is mixing half part water and half part liquid antacid. It makes something called LAW, or liquid antacid and water. You use it in response to pepper spray. We get a lot of accusations that we're doing this for kicks, that we're doing this because we're violent teens who just want to see violence happen.
I consider myself to be someone who's very fed up with seeing protests that accomplish nothing.
I did a lot of marching and holding signs and yelling in the street and getting permits, and it didn't really feel like I was doing enough.
I was aware that, you know, obviously there's plenty of racists in the country, but I didn't realize that they were organized and political and actively out to cause violence.
Seeing the state of the world and seeing the news and seeing what's going on, seeing how much danger people were in, made me want to get involved.
The term Antifa is short for anti-fascist, and as many people know, anti-fascism dates back to fascism. So we can see anti-fascists battling Mussolini's black shirts in Italy, standing up to Hitler's Nazis. And today, a lot of anti-fascists draw from the European tradition, and really it's at the front lines of physically confronting fascist and white supremacist organizing in the United States today.
There is no one organization called the Black Bloc. It's dozens, hundreds, thousands of autonomous organizations all across the country and all across the world. Black cloak or block is just what we wear. It's entirely black, simple, non-identifying clothing. You don't want to get identified by Nazis, or they're going to try and show up to your house, try and contact your employer, beat you up on the street if they get the chance. So it's important they can't find out who you are. But it's also important that if you're doing something illegal, if you're trying to punch a Nazi, then you don't want police to be able to identify you, and you don't want police to be able to tell you apart.
Antifa really exploded into the headlines in response to the disruption of the Milo Yiannopoulos event back at UC Berkeley in February, where masked Antifa broke windows and created enough of a disruption for the university to cancel the event. This created a lot of debates around different tactics for opposing the far right and questions around free speech.
Street violence is actually one of the last resorts for anti-fascists. The first line of defense is just finding out who the local Nazis are. People will post online with Nazi flags and post about the marginalized groups they want to kill. And when we find those posts, we save them, we send them to employers, finding ways to disrupt their organizing online, track them down and figure out where they live and try and make sure that they don't feel comfortable. There has been an increase in neo-Nazi organizing since the Trump campaign started, and they've absolutely been more active. The Jeremy Christian killings, the killings in Charlottesville, those are not the acts of individual people. Those are the acts of a political movement. Personally, I'm Jewish, I'm a trans woman, and I'm queer, and those are related. Knowing we have someone in the White House who calls white supremacists a side that has some good people is really frightening. I do feel vulnerable and I do feel scared every day, but that's why I'm in the block.
When you are a queer person or a disabled person or a person of color, you don't get to really step back and say, I don't want to be politically active, because your life and your existence is constantly in dispute.
To suit up in block and go out there with your comrades provides me a feeling of safety that I wouldn't otherwise have. When we appear in the streets, we're trying to stop these people from having proud marches where they can recruit and say, it's safe to be a fascist. And we want to go out and say, no, you can't do this. We're going to fight back.
We can make America great again!
Antifa knew before the Trump rally in Philadelphia that it was not just a Trump rally. That American vanguard who desecrated a Holocaust memorial with anti-Semitic messages were going to be there with weighted motorcycle gloves trying to beat people up.
One common tactic that you'll see being used is we will have people who are actually at home that are coordinating with the action, and they'll be checking Twitter and whatever other news sources that they can find in order to be communicating information to us via encrypted messaging.
It's important that we don't give the state a monopoly on violence. The police are part of the executive branch. The police serve Trump, who's a fascist. Police violence is no more justified than anti-fascist violence.
Who do you protect? Who do you serve? Who do you protect? Who do you serve?
Two common tactics employed by cops are snatching individual people and stragglers, and then kettling or like surrounding the whole group. Cops will kettle protesters and then arrest them for failing to disperse. Always be looking for side streets, always be looking for exits. Always make sure you stay moving.
You'll hear people shouting, tighten up, all the time, and that means that you have to stay together as one cohesive body.
The most violent people at any protest are the police.
Back off! Back off! Back off! The police are the ones there with batons, beating people up, throwing them to the ground, pepper spraying them. I've gone home with bruises. I've had friends go home with broken arms, dislodged eyeballs, brain trauma.
A nonviolent resistance really works when it can leverage the public opinion to pressure oppressive regimes or leaders to change what they're doing. The question is, when it's fascism, when there is no room for public opinion to influence the decisions made by government, made by leaders, is that a viable option?
Almost all people agree with violence at some point. Why do you support the violence of American soldiers and American police and not the violence of American citizens to stop Nazis?
I actually personally really, really dislike violence. I'm not comfortable with it at all, as I don't think anyone should be. So for me, it's about minimizing violence. So if that means occasionally being violent against the people perpetrating violence, I accept that.
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Richard Spencer, who coined the term alt-right and whose website publishes articles calling for genocide, after an Antifa protester punched him in the face, there's videos of him talking about how he's afraid to go out and they might need to get security and they don't know if they can afford it, and how if they can't have a public movement, they can't win.
We need to take very seriously the notion that anti-fascists aren't just going to scream at us, they're going to physically attack us.
And that's the point. If we go out and punch Nazis in the face, they won't appear in public, and like they themselves admit, they can't win.
Punch a Nazi in the face!
This has been going on for a long time with Antifa. Yes. They've been Antifa, they've been terrorizing people, intimidating people, and when they can get away with it, violently attacking people. These are felons. This is terroristic. This is fascistic.
Fascists aren't people who shut down speech. Fascists are people who want to commit genocide and ethnic cleansing. Fascists are people who are willing to scapegoat marginalized groups and destroy their lives and their health and safety in order to accomplish political goals. That's a fascist. Antifa are not fascists.
We're fighting against people that have been walking into black churches and killing people. That's violent. That's what the real violence is. And so to fight against that doesn't seem violent to me. That seems like meeting people where we're at to defend ourselves.
When the tragedy in Charlottesville occurred, when Heather Heyer was murdered, the mainstream media acted like the presence of hundreds of armed neo-Nazis was a huge surprise. But for those anti-fascists who had been monitoring the far right, were well aware of what this danger was.
Charlottesville was a really important turning point because it was the first time that there was no choice but for the media to show what was happening in a way that made the public understand who we are as anti-fascists.
They saved our lives, actually. We would have been completely crushed like cockroaches if it were not for the anarchists and the anti-fascists, because the police had pulled back and just allowing fellow citizens to go at each other.
There was at least about a week in America where anti-fascists were considered to be people that you could respect.
A lot of my friends are involved in the same type of activism. And so I don't have to hide it from them. But from my family, absolutely, I can't get into the details of what I'm doing. And I do lead a double life.
It makes it hard to stay close to people in your life because there's so many things that I do that I can't tell people about. Where were you last week? I can't share that information. It means that you end up forced into situations where you can't always be honest with people. My community is other anti-fascist people. These are the people who helped me through some of my toughest struggles. And so I am able to feel like I have family. There's a feeling of obligation and doing what's necessary in order to make the world a little less of a scary place.
I
After we got the Trump march shut down, they haven't come back into Philadelphia. This works. The Trump election has invigorated and empowered white supremacists and neo-Nazis, but it's also invigorated and empowered the left. We are on the cusp of some change, and what change that is depends on who gets involved and who organizes.
We are the people!
We are the people!
Money, money, people!
Money, money, people!
And that was the audio track from the Black Bloc Inside America's Hard Left. I'm kind of the view that the real enemy are the government folks in terms of police agencies, military, in the sense that they are the ones with the power, large corporate power, and that the groups on the right that are the fascist organizers are, to me, a secondary group. And I believe in acting to shut down speech against any group, you put yourself in a position where you empower the shutting down of speech against yourselves. And that's an argument I know that a lot of my colleagues don't agree with, but that's still my perspective. However, I do feel supportive of the need for a variety of tactics, and that's a phrase that I don't hear used in this video. That was used during the Occupy movement to refer to the occasional use of violence against property and particular kinds of self-defensive tactics with respect to police kettling and so forth, rather than what I call dogmatic nonviolence. But since we have so little in the way of protesting going on here in Santa Cruz that I'm aware of, and that's perhaps shows my isolation, these issues don't regularly come up in any practical way for me. Time for a musical break.
Taxes!
GOP went and gave them the
axes,
so their income will grow to the
maxes.
It's a scam that makes us want to
go and buy some Bitcoin to stink that. We will watch federal programs all shrink back. There's an army of people in pink hats who say everything Trump does is
like
a slap or hit groin. But then I looked at my 401k and think that maybe Trump is
A-OK.
We want D.C. to burn, but we'll wait till we learn of our latest Dow Jones returns.
Obama, we once thanked for the stock market drama, but for Trump's gains I'd sell my own mama. We are no fans of Trump, but we must admit this one thing.
Also got a new Roth
IRA. Since the stock market's great, his impeachment can wait. We can't afford the Trump hotel rate.
We can't move out of the
YMCA.
Announcement or two, actually, or one, actually. The only thing I see on my screen at the moment coming up in the next few days is tomorrow's 5:30 p.m. Drew Glover Council Agenda Discussion. There's a City Council meeting coming up next Tuesday. Rumor has it, and I don't have the agenda because it's not coming out until later tonight for us ordinary mortals, is an item around mentioning the infamous Loudoun-Nelson bathrooms, which have been closed since March thanks to the intervention of Supervisor Izeth Ray, who has been concerned about improper usage of the bathroom facilities, and so only the chosen few are going to be allowed to use them. And, of course, we will be engaging in a public protest around this issue come I guess it's September 3rd that we're going to be doing that, and I'll be announcing more about that in future shows. But on Tuesday the 27th, the City Council is supposed to have an item coming up, presumably on the afternoon agenda, and I'll be talking more about that on Sunday. But tomorrow you can learn more about that and every other item on the agenda, and you can grill Councilmember Drew Glover, who will be having a special agenda session. I guess he's having them regularly now, where he actually sits down with the whole agenda and goes through it point by point. And you can find him in the City Council City Manager's Conference Room, which is the room that's directly to the right of the entrance to the City Hall offices. So if you're walking to the council chambers, you turn right, walk to the city offices, then you turn right again, and you'll find a small door just down the way toward the street, which has the door to the City Council Manager's conference room, and that's where at 5:30 tomorrow, Friday, you'll be able to go over the agenda with Drew Glover. He's quite accessible. He entertains questions, listens to comments, and unfortunately often doesn't act on them, at least in terms of what I have to offer recently. But you can probably learn a great deal there, or a certain amount anyway, insofar as you want to spend your time hanging around the Santa Cruz City Council, which for me is always a really mixed bag. In the meantime, give me a call if you have any breaking news or questions, or are interested in helping Free Radio Santa Cruz, or in pursuing civil rights for homeless people. 423-4833 is the number to call. 423-HUFF, 423-4833.